From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, the new Marquette Law School poll finds that approximately 1 in 3 Wisconsin voters are still undecided just a month before the primaries.
Then, why dermatologists say you really should wear sunscreen every day, even if you don't spend every day at the pool.
As adults, we don't lay out on a daily basis. We go from the car to the house, and those are little bits of sun that we get every day. And just like hitting something, you hit something enough times, it breaks. That's just like skin cells.
Our automotive contributors discuss the new crop of plug-in hybrid vehicles.
All these run so smoothly and quietly and easily. You won't know when the car changes over from electric power to gas power most of the time.
And we'll have an in-studio concert and conversation with singer-songwriter Mark Arelli. Lake Effect comes your way next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Joy Powers. Wisconsin's primary elections are just a month away. You might think, given the passionate political stance that many people make on social media, that the races are all but decided. But according to the latest Marquette University Law poll, you'd be wrong.
The July poll, released yesterday afternoon, shows that about a third of voters in the state are still undecided on candidates. In the Republican primary for U.S. Senate, 30% of primary voters are undecided. Among Democratic primary voters, 38% say they don't know which of the 8 candidates they'll support for governor.
WUWM's Mayon Silver spoke with the director of the Marquette poll, Charles Franklin, just after the poll data was released to the public. He explains the big takeaways from the polling, starting with the gubernatorial race.
Well, I think the big picture is that Tony Evers has a notable advantage within the field, but with 38% undecided, it's still possible that things change dramatically. For the other candidates who are all below 10%, the question is, can they do something that makes them stand out and coalesce support from the undecideds, or maybe from the other candidates, that would let them break out in these last few weeks? We've had debates and forums and other kinds of things, but clearly from the data, a majority of voters have not tuned into that and not given it intense enough attention for any of these candidates to break out. Evers, by building his advantage over time, is emerging more as the clear front runner. But the question is there any challenger that can kind of break out and become the clear number two candidate, and then the two of them fight it out? Or ultimately, does no one emerge and we get a very splintered vote in the primary?
And if there's a splintered vote in the primary, how do you see that going forward for the Democratic candidate against Scott Walker?
I'm not sure that primary splinter or big majority is a huge issue. It's more a question of, after the primary, how much resources does the Democratic nominee have? How fast can they raise resources? We know from the financial filings that the governor has a lot of money in the bank. But we knew that going in, that the governor would have a very well-financed campaign. So I think the question is, coming out of the primary, can the Democratic nominee marshal some issues that are compelling for their side, and in a rush, gain financial support to run a strong campaign, not matching the incumbent from dollar for dollar. But we know from research on this that challengers don't need to match incumbents dollar for dollar. They do need enough money to be doing a substantial amount of advertising and campaigning, but they don't have to have a dollar for dollar match. So that's where we are. We'll see what happens come August.
So we kind of have a similar situation, except fewer candidates with the Senate race. Do you see the same issues?
I think the difference with the Senate race is it's only 2 candidates, and they're fairly evenly matched now. And they both have substantial financial resources, either themselves or through third-party organizations. So I think on the one hand, it's likely that cumulatively, the number of dollars for advertising that's spent in the Senate race is much larger over these last 4 weeks and fairly evenly balanced between the two candidates. In fact, I think it's possible that the Republican Senate race swamps the advertising of the Democratic gubernatorial race just because those two campaigns are highly competitive and well-financed. You can always have the situation in which both campaigns have spent down all of their money in the primary and therefore also face the problem of not having much cash on hand after the primary, while Tammy Baldwin has a very substantial war chest of her own. And so I think the situation we're in is both incumbents are in good financial shape, and both challengers, whoever they end up being, likely come out of the primaries with pretty depleted campaign chests. Then the question is, are their backers ready to pour in money to either the Democratic or the Republican challengers?
Well, and in the poll, you also mentioned that the incumbents have the advantage of being known.
Incumbents are known. It's both a good and a bad. A lot of people have made up their minds about Governor Walker and about Senator Baldwin, and so they're strong with their supporters, but they're also confronted with a lot of opponents. I think for challengers, the question is always, can you raise issues against the incumbent that resonate with people in a way that failed to resonate, or other issues failed to resonate in the last election? After all, the incumbents won their last election. And so challengers need a message that's right for the particular circumstances of the current election, and they need the resources to push those messages out, and they need that almost undefinable thing that makes a candidate appealing, and we're waiting to see about that.
What do you see as the issues for the November, like getting past the primary? Do you see anything is coming to the forefront? I mean, we're not there yet, but
yeah, I think I'll take a pass on that, in that you can imagine a variety of issues that have been mentioned at one time or another during the campaign, and you can look at what each of the candidates said at their convention speeches in May and June. But which of those issues they decide to actually make an ad about or make the keynote of their speeches in the fall, that I don't know at this point. So I'm going to hold off and we'll see how that develops. Almost always the general point is, has the incumbent done a good job or a bad job in office? But there are a lot of ways to claim that somebody did a bad job, and that's the challenger's task, is to say, here's what they should have done better, and also here's what I would have done better in those circumstances.
Do you see Governor Walker as infallible in this election, or do you see that one of the Democratic opponents could present a real challenge?
Yeah, I think this is an election year where national political forces probably favor the Democrats, though at this point we don't know how big that national force is going to be. Governor Walker has won his past gubernatorial races with 52, 53, and 52% of the vote. So it wouldn't take a whole lot to push that down to below 50%. But conversely, Democrats have run against him three times and failed to find the message to pull him down. So the national forces is part of that, the message is part of it, and having the resources to run the strong campaign is part of it.
Thank you so much, okay. Mr. Franklin.
Thank you. Yeah.
Charles Franklin is the director of the Marquette University Law School poll. He spoke with WUWM's Mayon Silver. There is a link to the poll from WUWM.com.
Summers are short and sweet here in Wisconsin, but the damage sun exposure can do to your skin can last a lifetime. How to enjoy the summer and still protect the skin you're in when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Bonnie North. Summertime often means beach trips, boating, and a slew of other outdoor activities. It's a time to get outside and take in the fresh air, but it also means more sun exposure. And while everyone knows the dangers of too much sun, the rate of melanomas is on the rise, and myths about sunscreen persist.
We decided to tackle some of the common misperceptions of sun safety and look at the best ways to protect your skin from damage. So we invited local dermatologist Dr. Deborah Scarlett to join us here in studio. Dr. Scarlett, thanks so much for joining us on Lake Effect.
Thank you, Joy.
So just to start off here, let's go over some of the basic facts of sunscreen lotions. You know, how much should you use and how often should you be using it?
So the recommendations are 1 ounce of sunscreen for the whole body. As Ben Franklin said, 1 ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. I recommend reapplying it every 2 hours and actually applying sunscreen to sun-exposed areas daily, such as the face, neck, ears, and hands. I recommend an SPF of 30 to 50. And just as a side note, most people don't apply sunscreen thick enough.
When we're looking at an ounce, what do we mean by that? Like, well, how do we picture that?
A shot glass.
That's what I always hear. Yeah, a shot glass, which seems like a lot of sunscreen lotion. But I mean, if you're applying it more thickly, then I guess that would be what
you
want.
So if you think about it, an 8 ounce bottle of sunscreen should only last you 8 applications. And I don't think any of us, even myself, go through it that quickly.
No, definitely not. So when we're talking about sunscreen, I feel like a lot of the time we use the words sunscreen and sunblock sort of interchangeably, but they're actually different, right?
They sure are. Sunscreens are chemicals that work to actually absorb the UV rays before they penetrate the skin. And sunblocks actually physically block the sun, like titanium and zinc. And you can usually note what those are because they are actually opaque or visible. So that's what the white paste
So they're
is.
Opaque like on your skin.
Correct.
Which one's better?
They're both good. It just depends on what you're looking for. To get the most broad spectrum sunscreens, you need both the chemical and physical blockers because some block only the UVA rays, some block only the UVB and certain areas in between. So that's what broad spectrum means. You want to get the greatest amount of spectrum to block the sun.
So when we're talking about SPF, is that referring to, you know, the chemical blocker, or is that referring to the physical blocker?
It's actually referring to the chemical blocker because SPF it only refers to UVB protection, and most of the chemical blockers protect against UVB. The physical blockers protect more in the UVA range.
I don't really know how to picture UVA and UVB. How do these affect your skin differently?
Okay, so UVA and UVB are both different wavelengths of light that reach the Earth's surface. So UVA, the easy way to remember is that those are the aging rays, and UVB are the burning rays. So most of us notice sunburns, those are the UVB rays. But sunscreens weren't covering UVA rays, and we didn't know that was causing damage because that actually doesn't cause a sunburn. And tanning booths are actually UVA rays. They can cause some sunburn, but not as much as the UVB rays, not as quickly.
So the UVA rays, that's what's going to cause you to get wrinkles, those kinds of things.
Correct.
But are they also what causes, you know, the more, not to be punny, but the more malignant forms of sun damage, cancers and things?
Both UVA and UVB have been shown to cause skin cancers and melanoma.
Okay. So how important is it to wear sunscreen every day?
Well, as adults, we don't lay out on a daily basis. We go from the car to the house, and those are little bits of sun that we get every day. And just like hitting something, you hit something enough times, it breaks. That's just like skin cells. If you hit skin cells enough times, eventually they will break. The DNA will become abnormal and a skin cancer can form. Now, it's not good to get a sunburn either, but daily sun exposure also contributes to sun damage and skin cancers.
But it also gives you vitamin D, which a lot of people talk about. When you have sunscreen on, does that diminish your ability to get vitamin D through your skin?
Sunscreen is only that. It's just a screen. It doesn't block 100%. So you are still getting vitamin D production. And there is a rate limiting factor of vitamin D production from the sun. There's a point where your body becomes saturated and cannot make more. And most people, 5 to 30 minutes twice a week, that's what the maximum amount our body can make of vitamin D, depending on your skin tone or skin type.
Okay, so if you have lighter skin, are you getting more vitamin D more quickly? And on that point, if you have darker skin, is sunscreen still important?
It sure is. I see African Americans, Indians with sun damage, particularly it's a cultural thing with African Americans and Indians with blotchiness of the skin, unevenness of skin tones. That is actually can be a stigma, the discoloration in their skin. And I've seen skin cancers in African Americans.
How high should you go with your SPF? Because some dermatologists have said, you know, those really high sunscreens like SPF 60, SPF 70, those aren't really doing you a lot of good. It's, you know, it's not double the SPF 30.
It is not. In fact, if you have an SPF of 15 or 30, it blocks about 97% of sun rays. And then when you go up to SPF 100, it blocks out 98% of sun rays. So SPF is an imperfect system. So I usually tell people SPF 30 to 50.
There are certain chemicals that people should look for. We're looking for things like zinc. But are there certain chemicals in sunscreen lotions that you should watch out for?
So there are groups on the internet that rate sunscreens. They recommend not to use certain sunscreens based on unsubstantiated evidence. And one of those is avobenzone, another is oxybenzone, and another is homosalate. These are actually organic molecules, and they were shown to have weak estrogen properties when mice were fed these chemicals. Now, it would take 227 years of head-to-toe daily application for this equivalent dose in a human. So they've extrapolated this. And then another human study showed that the application of 10% solution of avobenzone, which is 67% more than the upper limit approved by the FDA, showed no alterations of estrogen in humans. So they've done studies in humans that shows that it does not alter this. These sunscreens have also been around for 25 years. We've seen no other problems with them. I personally use these chemical blockers on a daily basis. I'm not concerned about their estrogenic effects.
What is the end goal of sunscreen and sunblock? Do you want to be exiting, you know, the beach the same color that you went in? Is that the hope?
Yes. A tan is actually a damage to the cell. It's your body's way of protecting the nucleus or the DNA. Think of it like an umbrella covering the nucleus of the cell. And the more sun exposure you get, the harder your body tries to protect that cell, but it's still getting damaged.
When we're talking about sun protection, you know, we also think of simple things like umbrellas or long sleeves. How important are, you know, those physical blockers?
I actually think those are the most important, and I personally use those as my primary form of sun protection. You know, physically blocking, wearing hats, sunglasses, long sleeves, I think that's much better, and that's less chemicals. So if you are concerned about chemicals, just put on a hat, put on some long sleeves and sunglasses, and you're ready to go.
All right. Well, Dr. Scarlett, thank you so much for joining me here in studio. And I look forward to seeing you out in the sun.
Covered.
Covered.
Thank you, Joy.
Dr. Deborah Scarlett is a dermatologist with Madison Medical Dermatology in Milwaukee. Our interview with her first aired in 2016. You can read more about sunscreen and sun safety from links at WUWM.com.
We'll take a short break, and then our automotive contributors discuss the new crop of plug-in hybrid vehicles. Lake Effect continues right after this on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Bonnie North. It's hard to imagine the world now without hybrid cars. But the first of these gas-electric hybrids produced for the mass market, the Toyota Prius, was launched just 21 years ago in Japan. And today, not only are there more hybrid options available, they've found a significant share of the automotive market.
One of our automotive contributors, Dan Harmon, recently test drove the 2018 Chevrolet Volt for a week. The Volt can get up to 50 miles on one electric charge, but did it stand up to its competitors in design, cost, and efficiency?
Our other automotive contributor, Mark Savage, has also had a lot of experience test driving plug-in hybrid vehicles, and he tells Harmon that their popularity is growing.
The plug-in hybrid market's just gone crazy the last couple of years. That's probably the fastest growing part of it. Most of the hybrids kind of came out and they were there, but the plug-ins being totally different and getting a different, you know, gas mileage because you're operating on pure electric for quite a bit, you know, maybe not a lot of the time, but if you're driving around town, it's a lot of the time. I would say, you know, there's sedans out there. If you want a sedan, the Accord has a hybrid. The Camry has a hybrid. I've driven those. They're very nice because they're basically, you don't feel much difference in the hybrids anymore than you used to, and the plug-ins in particular. What is different on any electric car is how smooth it is and how quiet it is, because initially you're running on all electric power. Now with the Volt, it's a little bit different just because it has a gas engine that will power up the battery. So you're always running on electric, so it always feels smooth, but you do have just a little bit of an engine noise when it turns over to the gasoline. And, you know, most of them are the same way. It's just that not all of them operate quite the same as that. Many of them, once you switch over from the electric to the gas power, it is the engine running the car and powering the wheels and so forth. So that's what boosts your gas mileage up there. And like I say, all these run so smoothly and quietly and easily. You won't know when the car changes over from electric power to gas power most of the time. You know, like I say, with certain cars, the gas engine makes a little bit of a noise. So now you now realize you're back on gasoline power.
I will concur with that. I actually, just having the radio or sound system on, not all that loud, and the air conditioning and all that, creates enough background noise that I actually had to pull over and confirm that I was actually running on gas. Like the gas engine was, it's a generator essentially charging the battery system.
Right.
But it is actually that smooth when it switches over. So it's quite impressive.
Right. One of my trips, I was driving from here to Madison and, you know, 30, 35 miles, however the range was that day. You know, all I noticed was on the dash, there was a little light that came on that showed that I was now on the gasoline engine instead of electric. So that's pretty seamless.
Yeah. And I'm using the Volt as kind of the basis for this conversation just because I had it for a few days. And I just want to compare features among other cars of similar build, other plug-in hybrids. One of the features it has is the ability to hold. So let's say you have 48 miles of electric only left. You can actually put it into hold and it'll switch over to the generator mode. And then you can drive down the freeway with gas or through the mountains and all that and save that electric part for when you get to another city or a town and then you switch into electric-only mode, and then you can use that to drive around the city where it is more efficient.
Right, that's a clever feature. And like I say, if you're normally a city driver, this is great because most of the time you're just going to be on the electric power. But then if you're out on the highway, like here I'm driving back and forth from Waukesha today, you know, I could switch it over, drive on the gas engine, which is going to be more efficient at highway speeds, let it run. And then when I get back into town and stop lights, I flip it back over to the electric and use that where that's more efficient.
Right. So you have options as a plug-in hybrid rather than a more typical hybrid.
Right. And a more typical hybrid, you're getting that, you know, regenerative braking that's giving you a little more battery juice. And it's starting on that electric motor to get you rolling, because obviously when the car is at its stop and then gets rolling, that's where it's the least efficient with the gas engine. So then it can, most of them switch over between 15 and 25 mile an hour to the gas power, and now that's where it's more efficient to go with that. So, you know, they're pretty clever. I think a few years ago, Dan, you and I talked about hybrids in particular, and I said, you know, this is the way to go. The all-electric car is nice. I know Tesla has done, you know, well and has better range than most. But with a Nissan Leaf or something like that, where you maybe have 120 miles or 130 miles of range, while that's nice, I'd still think if I drive to Madison, I'd like to know that I'm getting back that day and not have to find a place to plug in, because our infrastructure just isn't, you know, built to that level yet where you can reliably know, hey, I can pull in here and charge back up. And, you know, most of them, if you're going to get a full charge, it's going to take you 8 or 10 hours, and that's not usually good if you're traveling. If you're doing the 240 volts, then maybe it's only 3 hours. Well, I'm still not sure I want to pull over, in Johnson Creek for 3 hours and wait until it gets ready to come all the rest of the way home.
Right. I just, I want to mention one more trick, and I don't know if other plugins can do this, but just given we all know that I live, I think, not right now on the West Coast, and there's essentially a mountain just, you know, outside my door. And what's interesting is I drove to the coast and came back, and there was, and I had it in gas mode, which doesn't charge the battery. It just uses the battery, I should say, when it's running on gas. So, which is good for getting up mountains. So that's what I did. I went up, you know, I have to go over the mountain and back down to get to where I live. And I got to the top, and it still had 38 miles of electric only left, because it'll tell you that. So then if you slip it down into its lowest gear, which is very heavily, it's almost like it's always engine braking. So I went down the other side of the hill in traffic, and just, you know, pretty much stop and go for miles all the way down. It actually added 20 miles of charge to the regenerative braking. Actually was charging the battery, and I gained 20 miles of electric only. So I don't know if all electric hybrids, plug-in hybrids, can do that kind of thing, but it's to the point, if you live somewhere like this, you don't really have to ever plug it in.
You know, I guess I haven't experimented with that so much. I know it helps, because I know a couple of times when I've had, well, as I recall with the Kia, there were a couple of times when I could coast a lot and then brake a lot at stoplights, and I noticed instead of the 30 miles that it said I had, I ended up with like 35 for the day. So that was good, you know, and like I say, there's something else, another way to extend your mileage. It may change how some people drive, although creeping away from stoplights and so forth may not be good for your health sometimes. But yeah, coming down a mountain or a hill and letting the braking help recharge your battery, that's a great system. And the nice thing, too, about most of the hybrids in particular, and then the plug-in hybrids, is that the prices have come down considerably. I mean, there's still government tax credits out there on some of the cars. It depends on how many cars have been built by that particular car maker. That's up to like $7,500 if you're lucky to get that. But, you know, some of the hybrids now are starting, and plug-ins are starting at like $24,000, $25,000. And golly, that's right in the wheelhouse of an awful lot of buyers, considering the average price of cars is up to like $32,000 or $3,000 now. So it's not like you have to pay a super premium all the time to get a hybrid or a plug-in.
All right. You mentioned what is essentially range anxiety, is I believe the phrase that's used. The other car that is not a Tesla, that I think is pretty much a close second as far as range goes, is the Chevrolet Bolt with a B. They claim that it has 200 and I believe 38 miles on one charge.
That's what they tell us, and I've driven one briefly at a journalist outing, and it drives great, and it's kind of like a little electric go-kart. It really goes, but I don't know about the mileage. I assume that is close to at least accurate. I would guess that in our climate here in Wisconsin that might be a little bit lower in the wintertime.
Right. Is that enough range, you think, to alleviate the aforementioned range anxiety?
Well, I think it helps a lot. I mean, if you think I can drive to the next city over or wherever I want to go, first of all, the Bolt is a small car, and not everyone's going to be buying that to drive from here to San Francisco, but at least you would have a longer range, and if you planned your trip, I guess you could stop along the way and recharge. I think what it does is it means it's a more useful city car. It's now something that you can take back and forth to other nearby cities and not have to worry about, am I going to get home tonight or am I going to be low on battery charge? And yeah, I think that's anything over 200. I think you finally feel like, okay, now I've got a little backup power here, a little backup range.
Right. I think just back to plug-in hybrids for a little bit. There are so many of them available at this point, and I just want to get your opinion on the fact that a lot of them have maybe 12 miles of range or 20 miles of range on just the electric only. And I personally, I sort of dismiss that as them not taking it seriously. And that's why I think the Volt or any car that gets 50 or more on a charge, but is also still a hybrid, is actually taking the whole concept more seriously. So why are they even putting cars out there that only have 12 miles of electric only?
Yeah, 12 miles is not much, and I think that's, I had a BMW of all things, a 530, so it's a nice size sedan, and it ended up between 12 and 15 miles per gallon or per charge. I mean, and yeah, you're thinking that got me to work, but not all, you know, I couldn't turn around and come back on it. So you're always using the gas engine to some degree, it seems. I think if you're over 30, 35, that gets you back to that range where most of us are commuting to work. It's now something you can use to drive to work and back. So I guess the plug-in helps there as opposed to just a regular hybrid, because a regular hybrid, maybe you're going to get 35 or 45 miles per gallon, maybe 50 with a Prius. But at least if you're getting those first 30, 40 miles free, so to speak, although you're paying a little bit in your electric bill, you know, I think that is more useful. Now, obviously, if you can get it up to that 200 and plus range, now it becomes a much more totally useful car, because now you can drive to other places and take people with you, and just, it makes it just more useful. That's all.
Makes me wonder why, given that Chevrolet has proven that they can do kind of a mass market car that has the 200 miles of electric, why don't we have a plug-in hybrid that has 200 miles of electric and is also a hybrid, so it also has a gas generator, essentially, that would probably quadruple the range.
I think if the Volt was selling like hotcakes, that we'd probably see that. I agree with you. I think the Volt's a wonderful car, and Chevy and GM deserve all the credit for that, but it has not been a big seller. And they've even had times where they had to stop production on it for a while because it was not selling so well and they had too big an inventory. So I guess that's probably part of it, is that the consumers are not demanding that yet and not paying for it. Because the Volt, for what it does cost a little bit more, that you do pay a bit of a premium for that particular one. So it seems that people are happier with just the plug-ins that maybe get the 30, and they're just not demanding it yet now. I don't know what gas prices are on the West Coast, but I'm guessing higher than here, and we're already right around $3 a gallon. But yeah, if gas prices would go, let's say, to $4 a gallon, and now you're thinking, why can't I get something that has a little more range to it, and I only need one car instead of, you know, two cars for the family, then yeah. And Tesla's done well, but they've always been appealing to that higher-end market, people who are willing to spend $100,000 on their car and apparently don't mind if they're going cross-country, stopping every 300 miles and finding a station to plug into and waiting a little bit to get recharged.
Well, a good segue, because I wanted to, maybe our last topic here, I wanted to talk about the Model 3 Tesla, which there's, again, a waiting list. You put $1,000 down, and you have the privilege of waiting and waiting and waiting to get one that they deliver to you. What are your thoughts on just that model and the price that they're talking about?
Well, obviously, they're trying to bring the price down and make it more attractive, make it more of a, I guess, a Camry or a Accord fighter, because it's that sort of size car that's in the middle, you know, mid-size car range. And if it has good gas, or not good gas mileage, I keep saying gas mileage here, but a good electrical range, you know, then that will make it popular. But I think they have had so many build problems at this point. I think people are starting to get a little bit antsy about whether this is, how many of these are going to get turned out, and how solid Tesla is. I mean, I'm hoping that they continue doing this and that keep pushing the car market forward. But I just think it's the right car for more people. And it is, like you say, would give that person a longer range and be able to drive and use this as their primary car. But most of us, we live in a pretty much an instant gratification society here. And if I'm going to give you $1,000, I want my car at least within a week.
All right. Well, thank you again, Mark. We'll talk to you next month.
All right. Thanks.
Mark Savage writes the auto review column Savage on Wheels for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and SavageOnWheels.com. He's also editor of Scale Auto Magazine, part of Kalmbach Publishing in Waukesha. He joins contributor Dan Harmon regularly to talk about cars.
We'll take one last break and then have an in-studio performance from singer-songwriter Mark Arelli. His new album is a collection of cover tunes that he's played over the years. We'll hear that when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee's NPR.
Fare you well, my honey, my only true one.
Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Joy Powers. Marcarelli's voice has terrific range, and while that's evident on just about any of the albums he's recorded over the years, the range that's most apparent on his latest album isn't actually his voice. It's his ability to credibly cover songs from Against All Odds by Phil Collins to this song by The Grateful Dead.
Down Palace, on my hands and my knees, I will roll. Roll, roll.
Cover songs have been part of Arelli's mix for years, and his latest album is a collection of covers, appropriately called Mixtape. In May, Marcarelli played a show at the Cafe Carp in Fort Atkinson. He and Jake Armading stopped by the studio then to talk with Mitch Tyke, and they started with the aforementioned song by the Grateful Dead called Broke Down Palace.
In a bed by the waterside, I will lay my head. Listen to the river sing sweet songs to rock my soul.
Great stuff.
Thanks, man.
Broke Down Palace, the Grateful Dead, as channeled by Marcarelli and Jake Armading. Welcome to both of you. Thanks so much for coming in.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thanks for having us.
Thrilled to have you here. What revs you up about playing other people's songs?
Well, you know, I started out as a music fan, right, before I knew how to play music. And so covering other people's songs kind of connects me back to that part of myself, or at least ideally hopefully means that I never lose that part. So anytime that, you know, there might be any kind of weariness, even a slight tinge of weariness setting in with, you know, being me, I can, and not that it's hard to be me, but just my suite of melodic choices and the experiences that I draw on from my lyrics. I mean, I'm limited in my own imagination. So when I get to step inside someone else's imagination and cover their songs, it kind of shows me other lands that I might be able to go to, you know, eventually on my own. And it ends up influencing my own stuff.
Well, and I wondered whether you approach a song like that thinking, well, I'm going to put a Marcarelli stamp on the song, or whether it expands what you think of as a Marcarelli stamp.
Well, the only thing that you cover verbatim is the Beatles. There's there's nothing you can do to improve upon that. Everything else is fair game. I kind of feel like if I'm going to sing someone else's songs, you know, I have plenty of my own. If I'm going to sing someone else's songs, I want to be able to bring something to it. And it could be an iconic artist like the Grateful Dead or, you know, Roy Orbison or something like that. But you have to believe, in my book, you have to believe that you have something to bring to the tradition around this song, or else stay away and just listen to it.
Well, and it's interesting to think of the idea of a cover, because I you know, there are a lot of musicians who start by just covering other people's songs.
Sure.
And then they get to the point where they have their own catalog of songs. And it sounds like what you're saying is there has to be a point where you have enough confidence in your own material to be willing to go back and reevaluate those songs that other people played, and, you know, feel comfortable enough in your own skin to play them yourself again.
Absolutely. I mean, I think I could have made this record, which kind of has grew out of an annual cover show that Jake and I have done with other artists in Boston for 14 years now. I could have, I mean, we've been talking about making this record for a long time. I could have done this 7, 8, 9 years ago, but I wasn't the artist or the singer that I was then, that I am now then, and I didn't have as much experience under my belt, you know, in life. So I'm really glad that I waited as long as I did and brought to it everything that I have now, because I think I'm better off now than I would have been earlier on.
The collection is called Mixtape, or Mixtape for You.
I call it Mixtape, but, you know, in the album art, I couldn't resist putting in a little flourish of, you know, For You, Love, M-E, which a lot of people, you know, read me, but those are actually my initials, which is always, you know, problematic whenever I have to, you know, sign a legal document. They're like, oh, you are initialing this. I'm like, no, that is, I'm actually me.
The cover art is cassette-like.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking we're probably around the same generation here.
Sure.
I was wondering, do you think our cassette kids kind of the lost generation of music?
Well, it certainly was like a tweener generation between a format that had been around for a long time, you know, vinyl, and the CD, I think, probably had a longer run than cassettes. And, you know, I don't want to romanticize the medium of cassettes too much. They sounded horrible and they were a bit unwieldy. And, you know, anyone that complains about album art size on a CD cover, you know, obviously never transitioned to cassettes because they're
even
smaller.
Remember reading a lyric sheet on a cassette?
Yeah, they're half as big as the CDs. But, you know, every format has its limitations, and that forces you to listen to the music and interact with it in a certain way. And for making a mixtape, I mean, you really had to like hover with those fingers over the play and record button as the radio DJ was announcing the song, and hope that they didn't talk over the beginning, and then you had to stop it right before they started to back announce the song, and so it just forced a real tactile and intense engagement with the music and in listening, as opposed to just, well, I'll just drag this song over here into this playlist and burn a CD, that kind of thing. That kind of focused listening, I mean, Jake and I were just talking about this. Any time you put focused listening into music, it's going to sound better to you than not, regardless of the format. So CDs sound great, albums sound great. You could even argue that there's a certain quality to tapes, too. As long as you're focused on music, it rewards, because it's a different kind of medium. You can listen to music in the background of doing other things. That's partly what gives it its power, is like being the soundtrack of our lives. But it's also what makes us maybe take it for granted sometimes, If you're going to go see a movie and you don't look at the movie, you can't say you watched the movie. If you go through a museum with your eyes closed, you didn't see the art, Whereas music, it can be kind of playing, processed in the background. But it can also, if you turn and listen to it directly, it can be a very meaningful experience too.
And interestingly, to think about those first mixtapes that we made when you were there trying to record the song that you wanted as it was playing on the radio, these are mixtapes that you made for yourself.
Sure, you can make them for yourself. I mean, I made a lot of them, in high school and junior high. I was making a lot of them for, other people. I would make some for my male friends as well, like, check this out, this is music that matters to me. But for the most part, I was using them to give to females, and ostensibly you'd be saying like, check out this music, this really matters to me, but really what you're saying is like, you matter to me. And it wasn't just engaging with the mixtape on like a logistical level, like when to hit play and record and when to hit stop. It was like, well, what is the singer saying in this song? What do I want to express to this person that I maybe as a 14-year-old don't have the language for yet?
Well, I hope we can hear another song from the new album.
Absolutely. Yeah. Let's do a song by the band here. This is one of my favorite band songs, called Ophelia.
Boards on the window, nail by the door. What would anybody leave so quickly for? Ophelia, where have you gone? The old neighborhood just ain't the same. Tell me what went wrong. Was it something that somebody said? Mama, know we broke the rule. Was somebody up against the law? Honey, you know that I died for you. Ashes of laughter, the ghost is clear. Why do the best things always disappear? Like Ophelia, oh, please darken my door. Come on,
your number. Scared and running, but I'm just waiting for the second coming of Ophelia. Oh, girl, come back home.
Ophelia, nice job.
Thank you.
Hey, you look like you were enjoying that.
Absolutely, man. This is the best job in the whole world.
You were saying that the album actually is sort of the natural outgrowth of this annual concert that mm-hmm. you do. Was there a conscious effort when you made the record or the tape or yeah. the recording to kind of capture the feel of that performance?
Not the feel of the performance, though. Two things were very important to me. One, all the material was drawn from songs that I've done at the shows over the years, with the exception of the Grateful Dead song, which I did this past year when the record was released. So I wanted to draw on, you know, stuff that had been kind of audience tested and gone over well. And I also wanted to make sure that everybody that was on the show and part of this show, because the lineup has shifted over the years, I wanted to make sure that they were all part of the record. So, you know, Jake is singing and playing on the record. But the core of the record is actually a very different sound for me, with strings. I'd never had strings on a record before, and I'd never worked with this particular drummer before, Ray Rizzo, that plays on the record. And that can be very foundationally changing for a record. So, you know, I wasn't so concerned that it represent what we do on stage sonically, but I wanted the spirit to be kind of drawn from there.
I guess, that's what I was wondering, is maybe the show being once a year, this at least sort of kicks that spirit, you know, into the, you know, the 364 days that the show isn't on stage.
Yeah, I mean, it's actually been really fun. We did a whole run of cover shows with the band, and I did basically probably 75% covers and 25% of my own material. And I know that there were some people in my audience that, you know, they wanted just a little bit more of my original songs, and I really appreciate the intention behind that feeling. But, you know, this is just, it's important for me to stop for every once in a while and just celebrate music. And it's hard to do that if I'm playing I have the same feeling of joy and celebration when I'm playing my own stuff, even though I look like I'm in pain when I sing it. But it's hard to celebrate music playing your own songs. I'm sure there's some people with egos that are, you know, would have no problem with that. But for me, it's very important to kind of put myself aside and celebrate, you know, the purity of it. And so it really keeps me going.
You could almost do a KTEL commercial and scroll the names of the songs in front of you as you sing.
That would be great. Maybe that would sell records. Who knows? We could be back to that.
You have also done some work. You've covered specifically in a bluegrass style through was the Barnstar project?
Barnstar, yep. Yep, Jake Armerding and his dad are both in Barnstar with me, along with my friend Zach Hickman and Charlie Rose on banjo. And yeah, the Barnstar thing it started out as more covers than originals. And I think over the years, as we kind of sporadically get together, we've been kind of trying to nudge it more towards at least equal numbers of covers and originals. And, you know, that's a chance to recontextualize things in kind of, you know, more of a string band kind of context, and it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, I wondered if it was scratching, if not the same itch, but kind of a related itch.
Definitely. I mean, what the Barnstar thing provides me primarily is a chance to stand around, you know, huddle around these two mics on the same mic stand with five other guys and really be literally shoulder to shoulder and kind of, you know, it's like a band of brothers kind of thing. A lot of the times I'm not even fortunate enough to have like a single side man. It's usually just me and my guitar up there. And that's great. That's a thing. And I stand by that. But as a mode of being in the world, it's pretty lonely. And so to play with the bluegrass band, it just kind of, it's like being in a gang a little bit, you know, but a gang for good. I think.
And when you're with Bluegrass, a gang for good, yeah. I think we have the headline for
plus whiskey.
But it sounds like, to go back to what you were saying a little earlier, when you're with four or five other guys on the stage, you're also, I mean, not that you wouldn't ever be present with your music to begin with, but you really do have to be present because, you know, the five people on stage are all relying on each other.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you have to play and sing with each other and kind of feed on each other's dynamics. And then the way we play, you know, we don't use monitors or plug in anything. So we physically have to revolve around the mics and mix ourselves. And if we haven't done that in a while, it gets to that choreography gets a little bit rusty. and there's definitely been some bumped headstocks over the years. But it really keeps you very present and very focused. And that's the place where I think the best art comes from. So all these things are just ways of tricking myself to kind of stay invested and not coast on anything or, you know, develop two kind of set patterns.
Well, Mark and Jake, thank you both so much. Safe travels, and come back and see us.
Oh, I would love to. Thanks for having us. Yeah.
And what are you going to play us out with?
We'll play you out with an older song of mine, going back 10 years now. It's hard to believe I'm saying that. It's called Baltimore, from a record I put out in 2008 called Delivered.
It's an eight-hour drive up to Somerville, to Somerville, to Somerville. I got a big cup of coffee and a bottle.
That was Mark Arelli and Jake Armerding. Arelli's new album is called Mixtape, and he visited us in the studio in May before a concert at the Cafe Carp in Fort Atkinson. Our in-studio session was engineered by John Strelecki and mixed by Jason Reavy. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Bonnie Knorr. Thank you so much for tuning in today. Do be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect. It's here on listener-supported 89.7 WUW. UM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Stay tuned. It's 11 o'clock and fresh air is next.
Well, I come flying north of Delaware and across the Tappan Zee. Wondering what I gotta do to make you reconsider me. Well, honey, don't turn me back from your door. Well, I come all the way.